You are listening to a sermon by Heather Murray, recorded on Sunday, March 24th, 2019, at the Point Grey Intermennonite Fellowship in Vancouver, British Columbia. The opinions expressed by the speaker are not necessarily those of the church. This recording is licensed for personal use by individuals only, and may not be copied, broadcast, or redistributed without the prior permission of the church board. For more information, please visit our website at www.pgimf.org.
Good morning, everyone. Thank you for having me back. So, a little confession to make. When I was asked to teach or to preach, I'm going to. I said, I know, I'm going to write about modern pilgrimage. And then, as I was writing, it turned into a talk about mountains. And then I emailed someone that, oh, it's mountains now, but I think it got lost in translation, but everything still works. All of our selections and everything, it's still that connection with nature and sort of the journey of our lives. Okay. So like I said, this sermon is about mountains. And like a walk in the woods, my talk is a bit rambling and there are a lot of switchbacks. But hopefully at the end, there's a grand view of what I'm trying to say. Before I get into it, I want to ask you all, how many of you have some experience with Bible camp? Either going, working, helping set up? Okay, so I went to Bible camp for 7 years straight as a kid, and then I worked in Bible camp. I worked at Bible camp as a teenager. And there was this one song that we always sang, and I'd like to sing it, and I hope if you know the song, you'll join in with me. I don't know how universal this song is, but we sang it every year. Oh, now my throat is so dry, so I can't sing.
Okay, you got okay. Two glasses, thanks to Henry.
He knows. He knows. Okay. Okay. I lift my eyes up to the mountains. Where does my help come from? My help comes from you, Maker of heaven, Creator of the earth. That's good. When I was writing this, I didn't know if that would be a gutsy solo or singing along with me. So if you can imagine, every evening there'd be 20 teenagers and about 100 happy, sunshiny kids sitting around a campfire and singing that song. And we would sing, I lift my eyes up, and all of us would let our eyes float up to the ridgeline in the mountains at our Bible camp. And we would wonder, where does my help come from? After having such a tired and happy day, we could think about these thoughts. Singing it in church later on didn't quite have the same impact as sitting by a campfire in front of the mountains. The song that we just sang comes from Psalm 122, which we read earlier. It elaborates on the many ways that we can depend on God and how he helps us and protects us. But what really sparks me about Psalm 121 is, why does the songwriter need to lift his eyes up to the mountains to think about all of this? And why does the image of a mountain still resonate with us as something that makes sense to look up to when you're wondering about God? This psalm that was written about 3,000 years ago can still immediately conjure that vast, spacious feeling of what divine presence is out there. I did a quick Google search. What do mountains mean in the Bible? All the results I got explained that going up a mountain means you're closer to God. The explanations I read on multiple websites from theologians and churches all sounded a little geographical to me. So you're down here and God is here, and then you walk up to the mountain and now you are sort of physically closer to God because that's where God lives. But up here on my soapbox today, I'm going to put forward my understanding of mountains and spirituality, and why for me hiking is like praying. You gotta look up to the mountains to clear your mind of life's details, to look at vastness and shake out the clutter out of your mind. You can't think big thoughts in a small space, except maybe pretty chapels like this one. To me, the author of Psalm 121 reminds me of a Romantic era poet. So for those of you that didn't spend 5 years studying English literature like I did, I'll give you a quick rundown of the European Romantic era, which is roughly late 1700s to mid-1800s. The Romantic poets are most notable for their praise of the natural world. We're talking about authors like Coleridge, Wordsworth, Blake, Byron, Shelley, and Keats, among others. Previous to the Romantic era, there was an appreciation for pastoral settings, where the land had been tamed for agricultural purposes. Traveling over mountains was reserved for treacherous undertakings that you just couldn't avoid. There was no mountaineering tourist industry 300 years ago, and if you've been to Mecca lately, you'll know that it's huge right now. Plus, people had a very different understanding of the earth, as fixed and unchanging and unchanged. God had made it the way it was right then. It had never changed. When I was looking at my bulletin earlier, I noticed that Kevin had talked about the same kind of thing last week, which I think is a really perfect tie-in, because really works. Okay. Then geologists began to understand the Earth's very deep and ancient history, the unfathomable eons it has taken for our landscape to be the way that it is today, like mountains changing through erosion, volcanic events, and earthquakes. It's a scientific finding I didn't think about often up until now. But now, through the eyes of my kids, I'm seeing again how incredible it all is. They gasp at videos of volcanoes. They want to look at maps and trace the lines of tectonic plates with their little fingers. Their eyes are huge when I tell them about how the Himalayan mountains jut up because of two tectonic plates pushing towards each other. So when these geological phenomena were first investigated, the excitement of these discoveries not only affected sciences, but the arts as well. Just as geologists starting to take note of ocean fossils on mountaintops, poets and artists turned their attention to the impact of these eternally changing and striking landscapes on our spirits as well. How sublime it is to attempt to think of so vast a timeline while looking over so massive a landscape. The writer Oliver Wendell Holmes Sr. wrote in, I think this was about mid-1800s, he wrote, "After looking at the Alps, I felt that my mind had been stretched beyond the limits of its elasticity and fitted so loosely on my old ideas of space that I had to spread these to fit it." Romantic poets took up this idea that in vastness, you can sense the infinite because it is implicit in the natural world around us. Only through country amblings and ambitious mountain climbs can you sense a oneness with the divine. You can look up to the mountains. Where does your help come from? I'm going to read a couple of poems. I've done this before in my talks, and I always think, I'm getting too far away from the preacher genre. So bear with me while I scamper off the trail. Bible verses are coming up again. And technically, Psalm 121 is a poem too. This is from Childe Harold's Pilgrimage by Byron, which was written in 1816. "I live not in myself, but I become portion of that around me. And to me, high mountains are a feeling, but the hum of human cities torture. I can see nothing to loathe in nature, save to be a link reluctant in a fleshly chain, classed among creatures, when the soul can flee, and with the sky, the peak, the heaving plain of ocean, or the stars, mingle, and not in vain." So when he's in nature, he feels that he is one with everything and doesn't get trapped inside of his own head. The only thing he wouldn't want to be is part of the food chain. His soul can soar when he's mingled with all that surrounds him. The second poem is from Lines Composed a Few Miles Above Tintern Abbey by William Wordsworth. It's very long and definitely worth reading the whole thing, but this is just a chunk of it. So he's gazing down at a gorgeous landscape of a river valley surrounded by mountains, where he used to play as a child, but he hasn't been there in a very long time. These beauteous forms, through a long absence, have not been to me as in a landscape to a blind man's eye, but oft in lonely rooms and amid the din of towns and cities, I have owed to them, in hours of weariness, sensations sweet, felt in the blood and felt along the heart. And passing into my purer mind with tranquil restoration, feelings too of unremembered pleasure, such perhaps as have no slight or trivial influence on that best portion of a good man's life, his little, nameless, unremembered acts of kindness and of love. Nor less, I trust, to them I may have owed another gift of aspect more sublime, that blessed mood in which the burden of the mystery, in which the heavy and the weary weight of all this unintelligible world is lightened. That serene and blessed mood in which the affections gently lead us on. Wordsworth is saying that in his darkest hour and in his busyness, when his spirit is troubled and world-weary, the memory of this landscape settles his soul and helps him think of the goodness in the world and feel a sense of the sublime. It's almost a prayerful or holy experience that he can draw on. In times of need, even in a city crowd, Wordsworth looked up to the mountains in his memory. Where does his help come from, and where is the big picture? Okay, that's the poetry section. Now here's a story about Jesus. It's Luke chapter 10, verses 38 to 42, which we read before. As Jesus and his disciples went on their way, he came to a village where a woman named Martha welcomed him into her home. She had a sister named Mary who sat down at the feet of the Lord and listened to his teaching. Martha was upset over all the work she had to do, so she came and said, "Lord, don't you care that my sister left me to do all the work myself? Tell her to come and help me." The Lord answered her, "Martha, Martha, you are worried and troubled over so many things, but just one is needed. Mary has chosen the right thing, and it will not be taken away from her." Thank you. So you have Martha, who was thinking of the day-to-day, the ever-present details of life, getting chores done. And Mary is thinking of the big picture, her spiritual life, looking up to the mountains. And Jesus is saying that Mary has chosen the right thing. I love this passage because it makes me think, yeah, my house is a total mess because I'm such a spiritual person. I also remember reading this as a child and thinking, oh, silly Martha, why do you care about all those tedious chores when Jesus is there? You know, back when my mom cooked all my food. Now as an adult, I tend to think, well, Jesus, do you want to eat or not? You're only in her house because they want to feed you. I started singing to myself, I lift my eyes up to the mountains. Where does your lunch come from? For the last 8 years, I have definitely been a Martha. My three kids are now 7, 5, and 3 years old. And I've been a stay-at-home mom for more than 5 years, and I've been either pregnant or nursing for 6 years. I've done everything that goes with being a Martha. Cleaning, making snacks, laundry, waking up in the night, and something I never really expected, being constantly surrounded by noise, and three adorable humans asking me for something. I spend a lot of time indoors in my house. I remembered a newspaper article from 4 years ago about ceilings. Researchers found that high ceilings encourage free thinking and creative new ideas, and low ceilings encouraged diligence and task-focused work in their subjects. When people were given word searches The people in rooms with high ceilings would find words like freedom and inspiration first. And given this same word search, the people with low ceilings would find words like restriction and contain first. Small places really do make us think of small things, and spacious places really do make us think of big things. And when I think about big outside-the-box ideas and wide-open spaces as represented in the Bible, I think of the Sermon on the Mount. Scores of people were following Jesus around, wanting to know what he had to say in Matthew chapters 5 to 7. People think the Sermon on the Mount took place on what is now called the Mount of Beatitudes. I looked at pictures online, and they show distant rolling hills, water, greenery, and large expanses. My translation just says that Jesus went up a hill. He probably needed a space big enough to fit everybody. But I believe the effect of that is more than that. A sermon so very different to what they had heard before, so profound, challenging, and thought-provoking, had to be preached on a mountain. People had to be gazing out at the beauty of the earth, stretching their perceptions and their ideas of space and what's possible, without the tasks of work in the home right there in front of them to distract them. From up on a mountain, you're less likely to think, ha, my dishes are really piling up. Hearing, blessed are the meek, has less resonance when you're up to your elbows in laundry water. But on the mountain, you can think of the bigger meanings of the Beatitudes. I recently read a couple of books by a happiness researcher named Mike Viking. I can't pronounce his books. One of them is The Little Book of Hygge and The Little Book of Luca, which is the little book of like coziness and the little book of happiness. He cites studies on happiness that have shown that people are who are active in nature have more life satisfaction than those who don't. And he argues that the reason soaking up natural wonders makes us feel contentment is because our thoughts usually revolve about the past and future and the immediate past and future of what we've just done and what we need to get done. Intentionally spending time in nature, and he talks about hiking, hill walking, gardening, any sort of intentional outdoor time, is about soaking in the present moment, akin to prayer or meditation. Looking up to the mountains, in today's lingo, is like an exercise in mindfulness. So how does a Martha like me get some Mary time in wide open spaces? Well, my husband Gabriel and I take our kids on hikes very often. My three-year-old son, Haskell, needs to stop and cherish every caterpillar and slug. My five-year-old daughter, Rose, finds a lot of very special rocks and doesn't understand why I won't carry them for her. And my seven-year-old son, Hamish, needs to find the perfect stick for some sweet karate moves, and he also needs to stop and write notes in his special nature journal that he clips to his belt. It also involves us bribing our children with snacks at the top if they will just start hiking up the hill. It's hugely rewarding, but it's not a spiritual experience. So I don't often hike up mountains at my own pace anymore. But I did find something that helps, and a big part of this sermon is this recommendation to you. Not everyone in this room is able to bound up mountainsides like a mountain goat. Not everyone has the time with work and other commitments, children, upcoming exams, transportation, etc. So I've already mentioned the whole English degree thing. I believe in the power of stories to make people's lives better and open us up to empathy and new perspectives. People can dig their heels in and get comfortable in what they believe. And it's only through stories and allegories that their minds can be nudged in new directions. It's how Jesus' parables are still so compelling and can gently show you a new way of looking at something. So, if you're physically unable to get yourself up into some mountains, I highly recommend doing what Wordsworth did. Keep some mountains in your mind. Read books about hiking and walking and traveling through natural landscapes. It has been a huge part of my spiritual life these last 8 years. After long days of colicky baby, tantruming toddlers, and even cute little moments too, my respite has been in reading first-person narratives about hill walking. I could live through their experiences in nature, soaking in the spiritual connection to God's creation, as if I were there, sniffing pine needles and tripping over roots and rocks. Imagining myself in mountains, on the tops of mountains, looking up to the mountains, to the stars, allowed me to stretch my mind to big picture questions, to worship, to a spiritual place imagined in my mind. I have a little show and tell. I'll put these out. Maybe I'll shuffle that around a little bit later. This is a basket of books about walking or hiking through mountains. So I invite you to have a look through them and flip through them. If you want to, if you're interested in checking them out. And these books have really helped me. On my couch, surrounded by toys, dust, a pile of laundry, barefoot and pregnant, I could imagine myself setting up camp in a Scottish glen, gazing up at a starry sky after clocking a wicked 30-mile day, my legs aching, thinking about love and energy in God and the universe.